Ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
40 years ago, a fleet of trucks left New York City and began a journey westward toward Milwaukee. On board 16 semi-trailers was a precious cargo of books, charts, photos, and extremely rare maps, some of those maps dating back to the 1400s. It was the collection of the American Geographical Society, which was moving from Manhattan. The final destination, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. On this edition of UWM Today, we take a fresh look at one of the greatest collections of maps in the world, and we learn how they ended up finding their home today at UWM. Our guests on today's program are Marcy Bidney, the Assistant Director of UWM Libraries and Curator of the American Geographical Society Library, and with her, Susan Peschel, a senior librarian at UWM who spends her days working with this amazing collection. Ladies, welcome both of you to today's program. And Marcy, let's begin with you. This is a real treasure right on our campus, right in the backyard of Milwaukeeans, isn't it?
It sure is. It's a really great resource to have at the university, and I think make my map joke. It puts UWM on the map.
Literally, you have maps. Well, let's describe it for just a bit. You have artifacts that exist truly no place else.
That is true. So our oldest map is a map of the world from 1452. It's a map of the world created by a cartographer named Giovanni Liardo. And in the Western Hemisphere, it's the only place that you can see this style of map called a mappamundi. And so it is in our collection, and we make it available to people who want to come in and see it because it's pretty unique.
How big is it?
That's a really great question. Yeah.
Susan knows.
Yeah,
right?
we're making our
it's about yay big. Oh, well, it's about 2 feet by 2.5 feet.
I would say it's probably, probably 3 foot by 2 foot wide. Yeah.
So over 600 years old. What did they use for map making? What sort of material?
That's why it's kind of difficult to tell what the actual size is, because it's on vellum, which is a type of paper made out of animal skin. And this particular map, you can see the shape of the animal on the skin. Because it's the way, it must have been the whole skin of the animal, the way that it's shaped, and you can kind of see that. And so there's a whole treatment process that the skin goes through to make it last longer, to be used like paper. And then the map aspect of it is painted on top of that.
Ink or some sort of paint created at the time?
Some sort of paint created at the time, created from different minerals and other plant-based pigments probably that they had access to.
So that's just one part of the collection, but the collection is much, much bigger.
The collection is much bigger. So we primarily, over time, have been known as a map collection because it is such a significant collection, as you said, around the world. But we have this another chunk of the collection, our photo collection, which is growing and also very rare and very unique in its contents. And so we have probably around 620,000 images in the photo collection. And I always say that they are the, because people usually ask, so what's in the photos? So I always try to tie it back to geography because that's our primary focus. And I always say they're people, places, and things, and people doing their things in their places, the photos date from the 1850s.
Susan, you've been working with these maps. In fact, you were there when these semi-trailers pulled up. Tell us about how you became part of this story and now connected 40 years later to this amazing collection.
Well, I was a student at Montclair State College. At the time it was college, now it's a university in northern New Jersey, and interested in going into library science. And one of my geography faculty there Rolf Sternberg was very involved with the AGS in New York. So he asked if I had ever heard of it, and, you know, I hadn't. So I went into the city and applied for an internship. So I started in 1977 working for about 8 months there with the collections in New York. And literally my first day as an intern there, the people from Milwaukee were there looking over the collection with the prospect of moving the collection here. It had already been, committees had formed to try to relocate due to financial circumstances.
So here you thought you might be spending many years working in Manhattan with this map collection?
And... Well, no, I actually saw myself at the National Geographic Society in D.C. at that point, but, you know, fate had a different plan for me, which is just fine. I mean, so they asked me if I would consider moving to Milwaukee, and I literally had my coat still on. And I was like, where exactly? and so then when I graduated from college, I was going to get a library degree in Boston, but I applied here at UWM and ended up getting my library degree here.
And we're lucky that you came along with the maps. Why did it have to move from Manhattan? A lot of people may wonder, gee, you know, the capital in some senses culturally of America, why didn't they keep the map collection there?
Financially, it was a drain on the society. They didn't have the financial resources to maintain the building and the collections in the building. And so it actually, in one of the articles I reread recently, it dated back to even the early 20s, where they were having financial difficulties. The depression before that didn't help. And then the world wars didn't help with the finances and stuff. And as the collection grew, it just cost more and more to be there.
So Manhattan's misfortune is Milwaukee's good fortune. Marcy, the society itself, there's a long history about the Geographical Society, and it may surprise a lot of people some of the names of those who helped found the society.
So I actually might throw this one to Susan to help out. So the society itself started in the mid-1800s, so around 1850, and really to go find Sir John Franklin, because he had been lost up in the Arctic on an Arctic expedition, and his wife had sponsored a number of expeditions kind of unsuccessfully to find him. And so she approached the AGS and said, you know, I'd like to, for you to help me try to find my husband. And so they did. And it sort of then created this place where people would come together to talk about these exploration topics.
And 150 years ago, that's a time when parts of the world were still being discovered.
Yeah.
So
yes.
It was very exciting back then.
It was absolutely very exciting. And so, and for it to be happening in New York City too, there was no other place really for something like this to start. There were a lot of wealthy individuals who could donate the money needed to sponsor these expeditions to the North Pole, to the South Pole, to the American West, really all over the world, because it was highly unexplored at that time, and all of these men wanted to stake their claim.
And so, Susan, you're working with these artifacts, these memories, if you will, the product of all of these trips. That must be very, very exciting to know that you're touching maps and photos and books of people that we read about as part of our study of American history.
Yes, for someone in the library profession, this is the best job anyone could hope for. Working with the researchers that come to look at the materials and processing the materials in a way that we can access them quickly and easily for them, it really doesn't get much better than that.
Well, let's talk about how accessible this is, because I suspect we've whetted the appetite of some of our listeners who may be interested in coming and taking a peek for themselves. Marcy, people can come up and take a look at the collection, right?
We are open to the public Monday through Friday, 8 to 4:30, and always encourage members of the public to come and use the collection, ask to see certain things. If you walk in and you just are looking for a map of a particular place, you just say, hey, do you have a map of, you know, Sri Lanka? And likely we have a map of Sri Lanka, so we'll start pulling things out. Or even if you're just interested in seeing a lot of the artifacts that we have, like the Liardo map from 1452, or we have aeronautical charts that Charles Lindbergh used to chart his flight across the Atlantic. So to see these cultural heritage artifacts, you can walk in the doors and ask us to see them. It's my primary goal to get people to come and see these. We hold these materials not only to preserve them for as long as we can possibly preserve them, but also for people to interact with them and see them and learn the history and see how these pieces played a role in where we are today.
And for those listeners who may not be familiar, we should note that the Geographical Society Library is embedded in the Golda Meir Library, which is the large, wonderful, amazing library center right in the heart of the main UWM campus here on Milwaukee's east side. What about preservation? You talked about the animal skin that was used for that map that was created first in the 1450s, but since then we've used a wide variety of different materials to create the impressions of the paths of where people have traveled, and not always on materials that were meant to be around in another 50 or 100 years, right?
That is correct. I think one of the best examples of that we've been struggling with the last couple of years are nautical charts. So they are maps that are used for navigation on water and were primarily made to be used on a ship and then likely discarded. So it didn't really matter the type of paper that they were created on because they were not meant to be kept for hundreds of years. And so we have been processing our collection of primarily international nautical charts from the late 19th and early 20th century, so charts that are over 100 years old. And some of them you can see are on very good heavy paper and so have lasted a really long time. And then some of them are just on very thin, brittle paper that just can crumble if you touch it or try to unfold it. So we try to certainly be careful with handling these documents, but create an environment where handling the documents is still possible. So we do things, if we have any actual conservation that needs to happen to the paper, usually they go out to a paper preservation expert. We don't have that expertise in-house, but we can do simple repairs. We do what's called encapsulation, so it's putting it in a Mylar sleeve, which then it protects the map and it makes it a little bit more pliable, so we can use it and it can live in a folder without really having to worry about it falling apart and getting torn.
Because
more.
Every time you would touch it with your fingers, you have oil on your skin, that can cause damage too. Correct.
Right. Yeah. So we use gloves in the proper situations and sleeves for photos. We put them in Mylar sleeves as well, so we're not handling the actual items.
But it's so cool that you still, you know, walk off the street and,
yes,
and see these in person. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and this week we're talking about maps. The American Geographical Society Library Collection is celebrating its 40th anniversary of being housed in the Golda Meir Library on the UWM campus. In the studio with us, Marcy Bidney. She's assistant director at the libraries at UWM and curator of the Geographical Society Library. And with her, Susan Peschel, who's senior visual resources librarian, working with these maps now for over 40 years. Susan, as someone who is in the stacks with this material, you mentioned earlier that you're looking for new ways in which you can make this material more readily available. I suspect computers have something to do with that,
just
right?
Just a little, yes, actually.
So talk about what you're doing to help digitalize the materials that you've got.
Yes, we were fortunate in 2010 to apply for and receive a National Endowment for the Humanities grant to preserve primarily, initially was the nitrate negatives that were found in the collection. They came out with the collection, and they had been stored, and surprisingly, despite the volatility of the negatives, they were in pretty good condition. But the first priority was to get these scanned and put in proper storage and cold storage. And so we received a grant for $315,000 from NEH, and we outsourced the scanning of the nitrate negatives. And ultimately, all of those images, we thought it was 52,000, turned out to be 79,000 images, were scanned and metadata created and put in our online digital photo archive. So we've been doing that with maps, too. Over the years, we received a second grant in 2012 to do the safety film and motion picture film.
Wow.
And all of those have now online, and just checked this morning, and we have about 120,000 items that have been scanned and put up on our digital collections page. So from anywhere in the world, you can access our materials, and more is being added every day.
And no charge for this?
To look at them and to use them in a PowerPoint or something like that, a low-resolution image, no charge whatsoever. It's available with the information with each image. If you needed to use it for a publication, it's a very nominal charge.
I've heard that you've been able to track people all over the world getting online and looking at those materials, right? So it's not at all uncommon for someone in Europe today, right now, sitting in a Paris studio to be looking at these amazing images that
could be emailing us as we speak.
Right.
daily we get requests from any number of places, film directors or producers that are looking for a particular image of a particular place at a particular time, researchers of all kind, people who are working on books.
So they could use that as a reference, perhaps when art directing a movie or trying to recapture what a scene was like.
Well, an opening
that
film.
And to actually use it in
the film.
In the film,
actually use it.
Yeah.
All right.
So you know, if you're watching a movie and you see that they have old pictures or an old map, those have to come from someplace. And so we have this great photo collection, and so we get requests from people for these images to be used in the actual movie.
I was amazed as I was doing research for this program. Marcy, you mentioned Charles Lindbergh and the fact that you have some of the maps that he had in the cockpit with him as he made that transatlantic journey. But some of the other people from whom the Society has collected materials, Woodrow Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, John Glenn, one of our great astronauts who has material there. It's got to be, you must pinch yourself some days when you walk in and know that what you are taking care of, what you're preserving, is such a deep part of America's history.
Agreed, absolutely. And I find myself when we have groups coming in and I'm showing them all of these treasures, I say, oh, here's just some maps from Captain Cook. And I have to catch myself from saying just, because you do kind of, I mean, you get used to being surrounded by all of these really wonderful resources. But then when you bring people in and you see their reaction to seeing these things and even sometimes touching these things, it's a good reality check. Like, oh, we have a really special job that we do, and we get to interact with these documents on a daily basis. Like, you know, and people say, like, oh, this was really great. Thank you so much for showing this to me. I say, you know, this is my job. This is what I get to do every day, and it's really a lot of fun and really wonderful.
1452, when this earliest map that you have was created, how do they do that? You know, there were no satellites. There were no drones or planes to elevate you and get an overview of what our world really looks like. I mean, they still thought it was flat. I mean, are you amazed at the quality and the sophistication of these materials from hundreds of years ago?
Well, there was coastal navigation back then, so the coastlines of the early maps tend to be surprisingly accurate. It's the internal part of a continent that was more the mystery, and as it was discovered, it got more accurate over time. But the coastlines of their earliest maps too tend to be surprisingly accurate.
Yeah, so they would just be sailing, because that was the primary mode of transportation to get to other places, and looking along the coast and kind of just using certainly some math and science, I'm sure, but drawing what they were seeing of the land as they were sailing along. And that's how it started. And like Susan said, they're amazingly accurate for having been created without the use of something looking down and showing you actually what the land shape looks like.
I have to confess, I'm a map junkie. In fact, some of my fondest memories on family trips were driving as the pilot of our little ship across parts of America with not one map, a AAA road trick, you know, the triptych that they had. But I also had a state map, and I also had a regional map. And I drove my wife and my kids crazy because I said, look at where we're at. This is terrific. And I have to confess, in these days with Google Maps, it seems like some of the romance is gone, that, you know, you don't necessarily have people depending on the hard copy maps as much as our predecessors did. Am I just a romantic when it comes to maps, or do you feel that same way?
Well, fortunately for me, I'm still analog. My husband and I met in cartography class at Montclair State back in 1976, and we recently took a trip using the Google Maps, but you could only see what you could see in the palm of your hand. So we immediately went to AAA and got the paper maps that we could see the bigger picture. So we
the
still
bigger picture. Yeah, that's what it is.
We want to see the bigger picture.
Yeah, and so I mean, I'm the same way. Much prefer to use, as far as road trips are concerned, a paper map, because you can see where you are going and where you have come from in the larger context. I was actually just writing about this topic as well in relation to teaching spatial literacy and spatial thinking. Because when all you have is a map that's on your phone, you lose a lot of context about the area around you. And so your brain doesn't process space in the same way as if you are looking at an actual paper map. And so I really try to prefer to use the paper map because it's just, it's easier sometimes. I'd like to see where I'm going and where I've been and kind of look at different routes instead of having a device tell me where to go without really putting much thought to
There's
it.
There's room for both.
Yeah.
Is the rest of the world in the same situation we are, where more are migrating to an electronic form of delivering their map service than the hard maps? Or do you think we'll always have a hard map, hard copy in front of us?
I think that we'll always have the hard copy in front of us. There's something to be said for the interaction with these artifacts, be it one that's 500 plus years old or one that's 5 years old, that you can't get from looking at them on a computer screen. So often people will come into the library if we're giving them a tour or something, and they say, are you going to digitize everything that you have? And we can't really digitize everything that we have. But even if we did, people are still going to come in. Researchers will still come in, and the public will still come in, because there's something that happens between a human being and the artifact in person that doesn't happen when you're looking at it on a computer screen. It's a more sterile environment when people are looking at. I love watching people see these things because of whatever that is that's happening in that relationship with the object in front of them.
And to think of who else might have held that map.
Right.
You know, 100, 200, 300 years ago,
yeah.
Some other human was there, perhaps with the same sense of awe, the same sense of marvel of what they had. Well, we've talked a lot about the collection that you've built up over the years. What about going forward? Is the society going to continue to acquire more recent materials from discoveries or travels or trips from today's explorers and scientists?
Oh, absolutely. We get donations often, and we're building our collection every day.
So I could donate that big basket of triptychs that I've got at home, and you're going to save it because my wife wants it out
question.
Of the house?
Sure.
It's pretty true.
Sure.
Yeah, we get, as Susan said, we get requests for donations, people wanting to donate their things to us as probably as often as we get requests to use our materials, both on the map side and the book side of things, and also for the photo side of the collection that Susan manages. And so we're always trying to figure out how they best fit into the collection and if we want to take them. But we're also purchasing maps on a regular basis, both new maps that are being printed here today in 2018 and maps that were made in the 1700s and 1800s.
Well, you know, as we think about exploring space, and we now have, you know, some pretty fine examples of maps that have been created, not just of the moon, but of other planets. Do you think that might someday become part of your collection?
It already is.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have some. Yeah, we have some really fantastic globes, really, of all of the planets that we can get globes for. So we've got Mars, Venus, the moon. We've got multiple moon globes. There's one other one that I can't remember which planet it is, but we do have another planetary globe. And so every time, so one of the other things that we do collect that is pretty unique are globes. So we have more than 220 globes in the collection. So when you walk into the library, you're overwhelmed with the globe collection. And there are not very many libraries who collect globes because it's a storage issue. They take up a lot of space. They're awkward to store, but we actively collect them, including then the planetary globes. So that's, we're always kind of seeing which new globes have come out, and when they come out, we purchase them.
In terms of moving down the road, do you envision more of your materials being moved into the digital world? Are you going to try to acquire them in a digital format, or will you always, again, in this case, have hard copies?
All of the above.
Yeah.
All of the above.
The acquisition of born digital materials is something as UWM libraries as a whole that we are working on trying to figure out how best to do that. And so we will start doing that because it's a fact of life that this will be happening. So, for example, the photo collection, how many people are taking digital pictures all the time? And so eventually we have to be ready when a researcher says, I'd like to donate my photo collection to you, but it's all in digital photographs. We have to be ready to take that on.
Well, amazing, amazing conversation about an amazing place. And we can only encourage our listeners to check you out either in person at the Golda Meir Library on the UWM campus or online.
Yep, absolutely.
Right? Just go to uwm.edu and check
the
out
libraries.
The libraries and look for the American Geographical Library Collection.
Yep. Social media, too. We're on Instagram, so we're posting fun stuff on Instagram, too.
There you are. Really contemporary. Marcy Bidney and Susan Peschel, both part of UWM's library system, in this case, particularly focusing their work on the American Geographical Society Library Connection, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.